but not too terribly behind. I know that many of you have probably been looking forward to this panel a great deal. I know I have. And I think it's a proper way to conclude our few days that we've spent together to turn our attention now to thinking about the subjects who are represented within these industrial, scientific, and medical films. So to start us off on this topic is Snowden Becker.
Me again. Wow, it seems like it's been so long since I've been up here. I'm just going to get right into it because I want to make sure that we have time at the end for questions, because I feel like we have a whole week's worth of momentum behind us, and that I at least am very interested to hear what all of you have to say about what we'll be showing and hopefully making you think about this afternoon. So let me take us back in time 111 years now, to 1895, in which the first public cinematographic projections of the Lumières were held in France and Belgium. These film exhibitions were inspiring to the medical profession, who were a large part of the audience who originally saw them. And in 1898, Eugène-Louis Doyen, a surgeon who had a private practice in Paris, hired two cameramen to film him performing new surgical procedures, including craniotomy. He discussed the exciting potential of cinematography as a teaching and observational tool at length in his own private medical journal, which he began to publish soon after official medical societies forbade him to show his films during meetings of his peers. At the same time, Doyen's efforts to demonstrate the positive potential of film as a tool for science were being undermined by his own cameraman, who was circulating copies of the Doyen surgical films far and wide. They were shown in public at fairgrounds and elsewhere, and eventually became the subject of one of the very first lawsuits to involve motion picture films. Despite its obvious usefulness, film was accordingly discredited in the scientific community and the public mind after the Doyen scandal, and in the 100 years since then, it seems that scientific cinematography has depended on the kindness of strangers, if you will. Its advocates, although they have been many, have always seemed to be a rather ragtag and disunited group, and one that exhibits a feeling of having something to prove somehow through their good and reputable work with this technology. In surveying the history of films taken in pursuit of scientific knowledge of human beings, both in general terms over its earliest years at the turn of the last century and specific areas at the turn of this century, some interesting facts caught my eye that I thought I might share with you today. The earliest surviving Belgian films, for instance, are the more than 2 hours of observational and illustrative footage shot by neurologist Arthur van Gechten, dated from about 1905 to 1910. German neurologist Paul Schuster was using cinematography with the endorsement of his hospital department as early as 1897, and Romanian doctors were among the first to publish on the subject of cinematography in medicine in 1900. However, as with the rest of cinema's earliest output, very little of this material has survived. Given the smaller and, Doyen's pirated and exploited materials notwithstanding, exclusively professional audience for these films, it seems they have slipped away from us much more easily, leaving the same tokens of their existence, a few published mentions, and maybe a frame or two in a contemporaneous journal. Entire collections of films for teaching and study, which were amassed and known to exist as late as 1912, have simply disappeared. I would like for us to jump forward a few decades now to the 1960s and 70s, when a new thread in the tangled history of scientific cinematography can be picked up. This would be the use of patients' own home movies in after-the-fact studies of confounding disorders such as autism and schizophrenia. This is a body of literature that has emerged in pretty evident conjunction with the changes in amateur film technology. The smaller, cheaper 8mm cameras introduced in the 1930s were used to film the infancy of the first children to receive a diagnosis of autism, a newly described disorder in the 1940s. It is a body of literature that is still growing in response to those technological changes. New articles building on that research base continue to appear and now make more frequent references to home video footage. Last but not least, it is also a body of literature that has mirrored the progress of scientific understanding of these disorders over the years. And also, to my mind at least, echo some of scientific cinematography's somewhat frustrating progress away from shameful and misappropriated beginnings. The first home movies were of infants who were later diagnosed with autism, and they were case studies. They were reviews with a small sample size made by observers who were aware of patient outcomes and were not examining at the same time control footage of normally developing infants. Their conclusions about the home movies and what they demonstrate about the childhood roots of autism are consistent with the then conventional wisdom that autism was a byproduct of bad parenting and specifically bad mothering. Evidence in support of this was sought and found in nearly every one of the films reviewed, and the paper's authors have what now reads as rather dreadfully harsh comments for the mothers depicted in these home movies. They are pronounced to be the engineers, perhaps unwitting, of their children's disease on the basis of some 2 or 3 minutes of candid footage out of a whole toddlerhood or whole infancy. How lucky for the fathers that they were so often behind the camera and so seldom subject to the gaze of this 8-millimeter microscope. As the years have gone by, though, these studies have become better crafted and have taken better advantage of home movies' qualities and limitations as serendipitous, unintentional scientific observation. They exhibit more careful forms of scrutiny, controlled studies with larger sample sizes, outcome-blind reviewers, and they look for more objective points of data. This is both intriguing and worrisome to me for reasons I would like all of us to be thinking and talking about today. Films used in the service of science have, as I noted previously, a history of disappearing on us. Let us consider why that might be. First, many observational films, especially from the 1970s and before, are presented with a harumphing, clinical pseudo-objectivity which belies their judgmental nature and denies the helplessness, shame, and frailty so often in evidence in their human subjects. Patients are often shot nude among clothed clinicians, especially in the early specimen films. And, of course, physicians are not archivists, and they rarely have film archivists around to consult with when they choose to work with audiovisual materials. The field of medicine itself is slowly becoming aware of its own archival film history. Seminars on archival films are now being offered by the American Academy of Neurology, for instance, over 100 years after the first neurological observational films were taken. But just as practitioners kept having to argue for these films' utility, now it seems they will keep having to argue for their preservation. Then, of course, there are the emotional reasons that we may find behind these films' elusiveness. The individuals depicted in them have every moral right to their privacy and every legal right to it as well, at least until their death. Parents and families could not possibly be blamed for their instinct to censor, suppress, or even destroy home movies of their children before the onset of a difficult condition, especially if they felt they might be blamed for that condition themselves, or if the films furnished some evidence that even in those early, happy years, some things were not as good as they seemed. And the medical profession may have some less than proud moments on display in these films and related documentation, too. Obliteration of evidence is step one in purging or whitewashing any record. And who here does not find themselves feeling a little sympathetic embarrassment at the idea that many early films depicting suffering individuals vulnerably posed as objects of study, human animals rather than human beings, for at least as long as the camera is running? Or at the thought that while doctors, nurses, teachers, students have always been called those things in this context, terms like spastic, subnormal, retarded, and mongol boy crop up often in the titles and descriptions of observational films from not so very long ago. And autism and epilepsy were lumped in with psychosis and mental illness, respectively. The words alone can make these images hard to face. And I'm reminded of David Shepherd's quote from this morning in which someone else described a film as being not precisely cruel, but hardly showing the subject to advantage. Writing in 1899, the Romanian neurologist Gheorghe Marinescu said, "Cinematography allows us to discover phenomena that usually escape our gaze, but also allows us to re-evoke them with ease, to show our students various anomalies even after we have lost sight of the patients." As archivists, collectors, preservationists, and close readers, we are obliged, I think, not to lose sight of the patients in these films and to consider the deepest and most difficult questions inherent in this century's worth of visual records in order to guarantee not just their survival, but their effective stewardship as well. How, when, and why do we, or should we, view these films? Who has a right to control their content and to make judgments or draw conclusions from them? Where can they be responsibly housed? And in what context will they be most meaningful? What do they say, by intent or accident, about their subjects, creators, times, and consumers? Well, those are heavy questions, and I don't think we should start talking about them right away. I think we should start looking at some films. And we are lucky to have with us today somebody who can show us and talk to us about yet another category of scientific films. These are home movies of a person working close to the community of mentally ill and in a very specific context. These are films that were preserved by the National Film Preservation Board, so they represent an initial meeting of these two worlds, the scientific community that needs preservation help and the film archive community that can offer the expertise and the assistance. And I'm very happy to introduce today, not Tanya Rollins, who was unable to be here, but, Penny Withrow, the volunteer services coordinator from the Cherry Hospital. Penny?
Good afternoon, and thank you again for allowing us to be a part of your symposium. This is wonderful. I'm learning a great deal in such a short time. My colleague, Tanya Rollins, as Snowden had said, fell very ill this past week. They told me yesterday about lunchtime that I would be coming, and now I'm here, and I hope to be able to provide you some information today. I think someone may have handed out program to you, the Welpley Collection, and basically what that is, it is a treasury of 12 reels of 16-millimeter black and white film originals of approximately 400 feet each taken at Cherry Hospital during Dr. Welpley's tenure there. He was one of the six superintendent of the hospital back in 1938, and what we're going to see is basically the life that the patients actually were living on the grounds at that time. Dr. Welpley, I think predominantly when he was shooting film footage was just for recreational or you might say he probably had the latest camera technology of the day and he just wanted to use that, and I don't think he really used it for any type of teaching purposes, because based on what he shot, the footage, it was, a lot of it too, was of community folks that he may have gone hunting or fishing with. So you'll see a little bit of that as well. In fact, there may be, since there were 12, we have two that we can actually, I guess, that were preserved. I think I saw somewhere where he was at a moonshine still somewhere in eastern North Carolina, and so not sure how that got in there, but it did. Basically, the activities that the patients that you will see, how does that differ from 1938 to today? Well, predominantly the care at Cherry Hospital was custodial farm work. Cherry Hospital was known as a city within itself, so our patients pretty much did the farming. They did all of the sewing of the clothes. They made the bricks that were part of the campus, the original buildings today. So anything you can imagine, they were doing that. And if you will, if just a side note on that, if you were a patient that came in, predominantly you were left there to stay. Your families, there was such a stigma for mental illness, and families would send you there, and they would not come back to get you. If you had an outside job, you were the lucky one. Everybody wanted to be outside. They did not want to be confined indoors to any type of work. So, like, if I came in and they said, oh, we think you can sew, you're going to go to the sewing room, you know, that was kind of not really, I won't say a death sentence, but it was like, ugh, because you're going to be probably in a room with no window sewing clothes or whatever needed to be done versus those that were able to go outside. Also, the difference today, our patients today are involved in active treatment programming. They are there are teams of all types of personnel that provide structured active treatment or structured groups, basically to help our patients to learn how to make better choices, learn how to live productively, and go back into the community. So their length of stay now is an average between 7 to 14 days versus a lifetime. Also, basically, I think Snowden had asked me to talk a little bit about the occupational therapy component of that. Back in the 30s, late 30s, occupational therapy really began to progress. When I think of that, I think probably what happened, occupational therapy, was that it wasn't what we know as the tactile, learning how to function with different mobility and range of motion as it is today. It was just that. It was your occupation. Are you a farmer? Are you a nurse? That kind of thing. So the difference from that today, obviously, if you went to Cherry Hospital, you were going to learn a trade, a farming of some sort, whereas today you're going to hopefully learn how to maintain your medication, learn what side effects are going to set you back and possibly bring you back into the hospital, that kind of thing. Privacy issues, Snowden kind of wanted you to think about that. We have had some issues currently with the films that we have, not being allowed to show them because we've had to do a lot of research on the privacy consent issues. Basically, there is a case law review that states, I think it was the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company versus Body 194, it's a North Carolina statute. Basically, it references Section 2 and 3, that the obligation of secrecy extends beyond the period of professional services. None of the privacies of individual or domestic life, no infirmity or disposition or flaw of character observed during medical attendance should ever be divulged by physicians except when imperatively required by the laws of the state. As you know, if you're in a mental health facility and even if you're just entering your local hospital, consent forms have to be signed. And that's kind of where we are today with our films, is making sure that the state of North Carolina will allow us to be able to utilize these films in a, basically our purpose is to have a combined effort of teaching both, you know, historically to any staff, visitor, students that may want to come in, and also for any general purpose of that time era. And we are hoping that we will try to get more grant money in the future to get the other films produced. Because for us, for those of us that live in that area, and anyone, actually, it has been proven that those of us that have seen the films love it because we know exactly the history and we can follow from the early 1900s up until today. Okay. So I guess we'll get started with the films. And to note, these films do not have any type of audio, so I'm going to try to briefly go through them. As you see, these films were, we were given these films back in 2000. We do not know how long they had been stuck in an attic of the great-grandson of Dr. Welpley, and he sent these to us. So this is farm scenes, obviously, there on the campus. Oh,
We should note these films were severely degraded at the time that they were sent to the lab, and this is it's the fact that a visible image is derived from what Russ and the folks at Color Lab had to work with, I think, is very impressive. So this is really, these films have kind of been brought back from the dead in a very real sense.
To say the least. We were just so thrilled just to get this. I mean, just to give you ideas. And again, as you see, Dr. Welpley, I think just he was, personally, I think he loved his camera. And I think he just loved to go wherever he could go and shoot footage.
So there was a working dairy on that?
Yes, there was a working dairy. Anything you can imagine. The beef cattle. Chicken, any type of animal that could be utilized for food, they raised there on the farm. Not to mention, too, the dairy farm at that day, they supplied all the products to the patients and even families around in the surrounding community.
Could you say something about being a song
of colored people? Oh, yes. Predominant Cherry Hospital, when it was formed back in 1880, it served all 100 counties of North Carolina for the African American population. It was for about the first 85 years it remained that way, up until about 1964. We then became desegregated, and Dorothea Dix and two other hospitals, we split our regions, where the patients then went based on their regional section of the state. That's where they would go. Currently today, Cherry Hospital serves 33 eastern North Carolina counties. So we are from the top of the coast, like Kitty Hawk, Kill Devil Hills, all the way down to Wilmington, Calabash. Goldsboro, which is where Cherry Hospital is located, is about as far west as you would go in the state. So we pretty much have all the coastal community. No, it wasn't actually. Dorothea Dix was the primary white facility for the state. They were a little more structured. They did have some farming, but their patients seemed to be, they were not basically made to work the farms, if you will, while they were there in the care. It was more what you would probably see some films depicted. They sat on the hillside and looked outside. You know, that's that type of care. It's a little bit different treatment.
I saw there's a small child in that last segment. Would that have been the child of one of the residents?
It could have been. Honestly, we don't know. But because if you worked at Cherry Hospital as a staff member, you lived on the grounds as well. So it could have been a staff member's child. Predominantly, the staff members were white. There were some African-American attendants, but that may be what you see.
Any
I think in that day, absolutely. This is what they were used to. Anybody of that era, you were used to doing all of your work if you lived, obviously, in a rural county or the rural section of the state, and you weren't around a big city, if you will, just your normal self. You did your yard work. You did everything. And this is what they were used to versus being kept inside.
So this is a place where some semblance of a normal life could be.
Right. As normal as possible.
Are the medical records from this period of time available?
Yes. They are, actually. Because the record-keeping for the African-American institutions were very limited, very minimal, basically we have records of admission, ages, what the person was admitted for, possibly the county they came from, and that was about it. Some death records, but very minimal. on our grounds. Like I said, when you came to chair, you pretty much stayed. So we have two cemeteries on our ground. One is an one that we think patients were just put there. They're not marked. It's unmarked graves. We don't know how many bodies are actually in the graves. And then we have a section that there were marked graves, but because of over time hurricanes, it's on the river. And when the river would rise, of course, there were flooding. So the markers are just in terrible shape. So it's been very difficult to know exactly how many bodies are there because death records were not sent into the state. No, not always, no.
What's built on this land now? Is there anything built over it?
Currently today, right, some of the, actually new buildings were erected back with the Progress Works Administration with monies, and let me go back, in 1880, they had a projection of, there was about 100 patients in December at that time. Back in the 30s and 40s, the patient census rose to about 3,500 to 4,000. So many buildings were erected to house like female epileptic building or a TB unit, tuberculosis unit, criminally insane unit were there. So currently the buildings are still, the last buildings that were erected are still standing today. Some of them are not in use. Some of the land has been sold to other state facilities like the Department of Correction and also to the developmentally disabled units throughout the state. We have a section there. Our current population today averages anywhere from 200 to 250 patients at any given day. So we're almost back, exactly. And that's certainly based on medication. Mental health reform in the state of North Carolina, we've undergone a tremendous reform, which states they want everyone to stay out of the hospitals as much as possible. Again, turning it into more of an acute care hospital versus long-term care. The farmland actually start, we think, around 1970 when the human rights activists came in and decided that the labor was too intensive for the patients, that they were not being paid for this labor. I think it was based, we don't have the actual records from that, but I do know that some of the patients would go out to other areas in the community and help farm other tenants' farms for them if needed, probably board members of the Cherry Hospital board. And right, I think someone, I mean, it really reflects back to slavery, if you will. But there was no one to govern. You got, if you went to the state hospital, you were there and that was it. They left you behind. And that's not to say that that did not happen to everyone. Some patients would go home, but it was not very many. Probably not. It was probably just the room and board and probably the clothing that they made, the materials to make the clothing, if you will.
What were the predominant diagnoses?
During that time frame, early diagnoses were, it could be a love sickness, religious activity, pregnancy, venereal diseases, but certainly you had your schizophrenia, epilepsy, tuberculosis.
Was there any due process or criteria for accepting someone? You didn't like somebody, you didn't.
Right, now that happened. I mean, if you could show proof to the state, you know, if someone was in church and if you belonged to a charismatic church and they thought you were a little a religious zealot, if you will, they would say, oh, he needs to be at Cherry, and they could just send him. So there wasn't a lot of legal issues like there are today. I mean, there has to be the burden of proof. You have to be a danger to yourself or to others to get in. And someone has to, a magistrate, a doctor, someone has to deem that. This building does not still stand today. As you see, you know, it looks like it's the chicken houses. Actually, and some of the individuals that were there at Cherry at that time may have resided in the farm. This is like one of the many farmhouses that were strategically placed on the grounds. Like I said, Dr. Wepley had a fascination, I guess, with the farm animals. But now also, to note, the reels of film that we have, like I said, we would like to be able to view all of them. We also were given about 1,300 negatives that were also found with the reels of film, and we were able to scan those in, and we can depict what actually were happening. Now, he actually had certain patients that he would line up and take their pictures. We don't know why. There's no story. There's no caption. He just did that. And we are guessing those are the folks that maybe he worked with. But he would also have pictures of the staff's children's birthday parties or a Christmas on the ward. Some inside scenes, but mostly it was all outdoors. Of course, hay fields, the haystacks, as you see. Right, no, none of that. Basically, it's just personal diaries that he kept while he was there, and he would day-to-day might have one or two sentences. But right, possibly staff children in that photo. That was our main building, the very first building that was erected. That's the old grain silo. That is still standing today. In fact, our building that I'm located in is right in front of that grain silo, so it's fascinating to know we were the cow pasture. We were now located in the cow pasture, but that building was known as the castle. No, that building was torn down and new buildings were erected.
Was there a chapel on the site or a church?
There was a church on the site. We have an actual full chapel today, but there was one kind of like on the outskirts of the hospital. We've had them as young as 3 years old, which we did not like. It's hard to imagine that someone would say that a 3-year-old has a mental illness and needs to be institutionalized. But when we had our latency unit, the average was anywhere between 5 to 7 was the youngest, was what we would take.
And it sounds like that has since closed.
That has closed. We now only serve adolescents, which today is from ages 13 to 17. We have an adult acute admissions unit that runs from 18 to 60 years of age, and they're all co-ed. And then we have what we consider our long-term unit. That's for folks that need more than, say, a 2-week stay, or some of our patients that are in there today have been there pretty much all their life. It's not very many, maybe 5 to 10. They were institutionalized early, maybe possibly the 60s, and they've been there. And then we also have a TB unit today and a psych med unit. Again, staff, this was more than likely staff's children, and this was a duck pond. This lady we see here, he has a lot of photos of her, and it's questionable to know exactly what their relationship was at the time. One can possibly guess, but you know, but... I'm really not sure of that answer, to be honest. I apologize that Tanya would have known the answer to that question. My guess are maybe these were some that were maybe better able to preserve. The other ones, because they're in such poor shape, poor conditions. So.
And then there's the index from Dr. Welby's
paper. Right. And maybe that's what they chose, what they thought they could look, see through. So, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Zoe Beloff.